Welcome to The Shining 237, the podcast where we look at Stanley Kubrick's horror masterpiece, The Shining, in 2 minute and 37 second bloody chunks. My name is Susan Tekla Kruglenska, and this is a special episode. We're just about to hit the halfway point in the movie. I thought it would be fun to put together a little best of. It's kind of a sampler of the podcast. I thought it'd be fun to go back and pick out some of the best bits, whether it be funny or interesting or philosophical. I hope regular listeners enjoy listening to this. Also, it's a great sampler for anyone who hasn't heard the show before, so please do pass this along. This is a very modest podcast as of this recording, May 2018. I still am trying to get more listeners. I appreciate it if you'd pass this episode along to anybody you think really loves The Shining. So do enjoy this best of episode. I will list the guests I've had at the end of the show. And also we'll list everything on my website, theshining237.com. We go from the logo to black to the opening shot, which I think is one of the greatest opening shots in any movie. It's a aerial view of what we now know is Glacier National Park. Right. We are supposed to assume it's the Rockies because that's where this film takes place.
Not Maine.
It's definitely not Maine. Yeah.
Not Maine.
Not Maine. It is not Maine. And then the other thing is, in that car, as we're looking at it from our eagle eye view, there are three people in that car dressed up as Jack, Wendy, and Danny.
Can you see them?
You can really see them?
No, you can't. You really can't see them.
Oh my God.
They did it. They were in the exact same clothes as the characters. So
Stanley would know.
Stanley would know.
The audience may not see, but Stanley would know.
Yes. They talk about the overlook in the winter. Jack says, do you mind if I ask why you keep the place closed down? It seems to me the ski up here would be fantastic. Oh, it sure would, Ullman says. But the problem is the enormous cost it would be to keep the road to the Sidewinder open. Now, are we buying that?
Well, I found out it's not true. The real Timberline Lodge, where that actually is in Oregon, they are open for the winter and they do have skiing. And thank God, otherwise there'd be so many murders if they closed for the winter.
Yeah.
So many families killed.
Stanley had said to Leon what he wanted in a child. It was a child with mobile features, and he wanted the child's muscles to be connected to his nerve center by direct line. Those were his instructions. And I look for
that in a cell phone, too. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, nowadays, that's a procedure you can have done.
Yes.
You can have your child.
Or you can have Botox to stop that.
You want your child to make it big in movies, you go and have them get this procedure.
Stanley assigned Leon to be Danny's acting coach.
Right.
Not directing him, which Leon always makes the distinction. He would never claim that, but he was his acting coach. And that's what Danny also says. They clicked so much. So Leon would take him through playing. Let's play that you're scared.
Yeah.
Let's play that your dad walks in and he sees you taking money from the drawer. And he insists, you know, that you're a bad boy. And what would you say? And then they would improv and they would play. And he would get him to the point where he would just say, no, you have to be more scared. And then Danny just would go along with it.
When the Manson murders happened after they discovered who it was, and that a lot of people in Hollywood, one way or another, had some either direct or casual acquaintance to the people who were accused of the murders at the Tate Estate. Everyone got really, really paranoid and afraid, and there was suddenly everyone had walls, everyone had gates, everyone had security. Steve McQueen started carrying guns.
And Jack Nicholson, in particular, was completely shaken up to his core. I've read he was sleeping with a hammer under his pillow.
That's a terrifying thought.
He actually attended some of the trial, I believe. He was pretty obsessed, and some say he based part of his role of Jack Torrance on Manson, which is a little bit freaky when you think about it. Scatman Crothers is the next name.
Scatman Crothers.
Now, Stanley Kubrick's first pick for this was Slim Pickens.
Kubrick wanted Slim Pickens for the role because Slim Pickens had worked with him on Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And Slim Pickens did not want to be in the movie for the exact same reason.
Yes, exactly. He was like, no, thank you.
Beat me to that joke, yes.
Did any actors ever quit on him?
He would fire people, but I don't know any stories of people quitting. Right. There are a few stories of people who are pretty upset with their experience, but most of the stories, overwhelmingly, people ultimately were so happy for their experience. And in fact, Shelley Duvall, I have quotes from her, you know, she said it was almost unbearable working for him, but from another point of view, really very nice, I suppose. For a person so charming, so likable, and so lovable, he can do some pretty cruel things when you're filming, but it seems to me that the ends justified the means. And then she said, I wouldn't trade the experience for anything, but I wouldn't want to go through it again.
Yeah, so there you go. You know, it's worth it. Like if he were terrible and a hack, people would go like, life is too short. I'm sorry. I don't need this money so badly. I don't even know what he paid these people, but I'm sure they would have worked for free.
Also, we should also acknowledge that there's nothing Jack can do about his eyebrows. Now,
there's a reaction shot from Jack Nicholson where he's doing the eyebrow thing. And, like, first of all, his eyebrows have too many joints in them. But at the same time, like, when his joint eyebrows, like, come up and fold into all of their weird origami angles, it creates this crease across the middle of his head.
Yeah.
And he's got his head lowered, so his chin is in really sharp relief. And in that shot, it, honest to God, looks like his whole face could just, like, pop off. Like, he's in Anomalisa or, like, maybe a Laika movie, and... like he's stop motion animated, and the way you get the next face is to just like pop that faceplate off and pop a new one on.
One more thing I thought was interesting was Danny talking about seeing cannibalism on TV in the year 1980 or 79 or 78, you know, since that's kind of when this was filmed. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, where did he see cannibalism on TV? Because TV was not that rough back then. We did not have zombies, you know, on every single station.
I mean, there was one episode of Donnie and Marie where things got plenty rough.
I have to imagine there was the gag of the, you know, the witch doctor and the big black cauldron and the guy in the safari hat. That must have showed up on various cartoons. I know Bugs Bunny.
Ding, ding, ding.
But Bugs Bunny is not, it's not cannibalism unless it's a rabbit that's about to eat a rabbit. What's the ding, ding for?
The ding, ding is... there was one of the best Bugs Bunny episodes ever made is Waikiki Rabbit.
Oh, with the hot dog and the hamburger.
Yes.
Yep.
And that was shown right, over ad right. nauseum in our day, but came from that after school Bugs Bunny culture that clearly Danny was part of because he's got his Bugs Bunny t-shirt on from the get-go. He's watching Roadrunner throughout. He had two points in the movie he's watching Roadrunner. Waikiki Rabbit, 1943. And where you have two guys, it opens with them, one of them salting the other's knee because he wants to eat it. They're like floating on a raft in the middle of the sea. They're lost at sea. And they're just like drooling over eating each other. And it ends, of course, Bugs Bunny tricks them out of the boat. He gets on the boat. They stay on the island and they end the episode chasing after each other, seeing each other as one as a hot dog, one as a hamburger.
Sure.
And I thought, that's it. That's where he learned about it. Of course, you know. It's
awesome. Bugs Bunny was kind of an asshole.
Almost all his movies either have the title cards or some narration. He liked taking shortcuts like that. He thought that was completely legit, a legit thing to do in a movie, and it was economical. And why not? That was his philosophy. Although he didn't like using it in The Killing, which I think that kind of ruined that movie. Okay.
What? You don't like the mellifluous sound of Sterling Hayden's voice?
Also, not to harp too much on Watson, but I realize that I quote Barry Denon from time to time, which I didn't realize that I did until researching this segment, because he's Claude Lamont, the explorer in Kentucky Fried Movie.
Oh.
I live the unknown, I love the unknown, I am the unknown. And then the host asks him, like, so, Claude, where are you living these days? And he says, that is unknown, I do not know.
So Danny sees the twins, and a lone kid or twins are, as movies have taught us, terrifying, but I started to think about the fact that Danny seeing a lone girl dressed like that, or twins dressed like that, very scary, but triplets would have looked ridiculous.
It would have been a comedy. It would have been a comedy.
I started thinking about at what number does it turn frightening again? Like triplets,
sure.
Quadruplets, quintuplets. But again, if all of a sudden there were, say, 9 girls dressed like that, I think it might become scary again.
What about 7? I would think 7 is kind of a mystical number. Do you not think 7 would...
Are they lined up in a row, or are they...
They're forming a human pyramid.
That's one of my favorite things. So that would not be scary. I'd be delighted.
All right, so Susie's holding Danny's hand. They enter, and she says, I found him outside looking for you. Okay, so outside...
His father says to... What does his father say to him? He brings him in, and he says, hi, Dan. His father calls him Dan. Yeah.
Dan
doesn't seem terribly happy
to
see him.
What the hell is that?
He's putting on a show of being happy to see his son because there's people around. And then he says to him this very curious thing. He says, got tired of bombing the universe. Father shoved him into the game room. So, oh, there's the game room. Go in there. And is under the impression that there are arcade video games in there, even though we didn't see any, and Danny was left playing with nothing but sharp darts, like a guy in a like an old guy in a pub, because that's the kind of games that were in there. And his father didn't even care enough to check if it was a game room for children with arcade games or a game room for people who want to smoke cigars and play poker, which is clearly what it really is.
In a strange location, filled with people exiting and going out of state, anybody could have kidnapped this kid, shoved him in their car, and gone.
It's a great way to kidnap a kid. Is something where there's a lot of activity. Nobody's going to look twice if you grab some kid.
Now, we have emphasized that the 70s were a much more liberal time for parenting. But this is ridiculous. This is insane.
Yeah.
So this kid is, and so what ends up happening, he doesn't poke his eye out with a dart. He sees two dead girls who giggle at him. And he, I mean, the, you know, so he's, I'm imagining he was in shock. I mean, when Susie found him, that he was
just wandering the grounds, not even knowing where he was.
Like with his mouth hanging open, right?
Help me. Help me. Yes. Anybody help me, please.
Oh my God. It's just horrifying to think about.
Obviously, there's the framing of the baking soda that ties into the Native American theme as well. That's right behind Halloran when he communicates with Danny.
Right. So that's right. It's Calmet baking soda, which was from it began in the 1880s by William Wright, who was a Chicago baking powder salesman. And he decided to make a better baking powder. And by God, he did it. And they are now owned by Kraft. Calmet means peace pipe. It's an Indian, it's some Native American word. I'm not sure what language, but the slogan is baker's best and always pleases, which is a terrible slogan, but they still did very well. And you can buy Calmet baking powder right now, this minute, on Amazon if you wanted to. But it is interesting, like the theorists, it seems like a silly theory to say that he's showing this can of baking soda and there's some significance to it. But the way it's placed all by itself, and it sort of as a color pops out at you, it does pop. It is debatable. I'd say it's the placement is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's blue. The blues on the can definitely sync up with Halloran's coat, I think.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. I think that of all the, you know, crazy theories, I think this one probably has more credence than a lot of the others do. I think it's definitely something that Kubrick wanted the viewer to be thinking about in that particular moment.
Yeah. And notice right behind Danny's head in the same scene is minced clams.
Oh my God, we loved it. Louise and Lisa Burns say about their once in a lifetime gig working with Kubrick. Every day felt like we'd been invited to a very exclusive party and we were the youngest, luckiest people to be there.
Louise said he was so nice. It's hard to believe he made a horror movie. And Lisa said he was a huge softy. And they also report that he ate potato salad every day.
Hmm.
So that's, make of that what you will.
I was going to say, that might be the most terrifying thing that's been said so far.
That may be creepier than the twins. I don't know. My theory on Ullman is that he gets in the off season, he closes up the hotel, he puts on his leather jacket, and he gets on his motorcycle, and then he just spends months just riding around from town to town, getting into adventures, and much like then came Bronson. So he just moves around, and it's a whole nother life for him. And I don't think his hair is a toupee. I think he keeps it. He wears it in like a big pompadour like that because he's a throwback 50s greaser. He's an aging 50s greaser.
That's a beautiful theory too, because that works perfectly. Like I have no doubt Ullman has a motorcycle. Now picture Watson sitting in the back of it.
Oh, he's sidecar. He's totally sidecar.
Sidecar Watson. Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't get
sidecar holding Ullman's Chinese takeout food.
Yeah, and if Ullman's going to find a cool bar going there, there's going to be chicks in there, he's going to ask Watson to wait outside.
Scatman, I had just glossed over his history last episode, but I didn't really emphasize enough what a musician he was. You know, he played drums, but then he learned guitar and he sang, and he was this very versatile performer. He wrote like hundreds of songs. He just was addicted to writing songs. He would write songs in his sleep. And he actually, during the filming of The Shining, wrote a song about Stanley Kubrick.
Doom, shoo, bing, da, doom, shoo, ding, doom, shoo, ding, da, doom. There's a man, doom, bing, doom, shoo, bing, da, doom, shoo, bing, living in London town, shoo, bing, da, doom, shoo, bing, da, doom, shoo, ding, da, doom, makes movies. Shoo, bing, da, doom, shoo, bing, da, doom, he's a world renowned, shoo, bing, da, boom, shoo, bing, da, boom, shoo, bing, da, boom. Yes, he's really got the fame, Stanley Kubrick is his name, he does it all. Shoo, ding, doom, shoo, bing, da, doom, shoo, bing, da, doom.
And Wendy's kind of flipped too. You know, she's not the blonde cheerleader in the book. You know, she's a darker, of course, mousy is the word that always comes up, but you know, it is what Kubrick was going for. And, I actually love Wendy. I love Shelley Duvall's portrayal. She actually did catch some shit for, you know, people kind of say it's an annoying character. You know, I don't know what you think of that. I think she's great.
I've heard that a lot. Growing up, but I think she kind of, I guess you almost have to, not any disrespect to Stephen King, but when you take Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, you almost have to kind of like forget about the book for like 2 hours and just kind of, it's its own entity. And yeah, I like Shelley Duvall's portrayal. I always feel a little bad for Shelley Duvall because, you know, it's not even just that she was kind of, she had tension, I guess is the word, you know, like offset, you know, working with Stanley Kubrick, but a lot of big films, you know, she was a Robert Altman regular, and Robert Altman wasn't the nicest to her either. So it's like a lot of her roles, you know, that she's known for, whether it be Three Women or The Shining, there was always kind of like she had to deal with a heavy role. And then as soon as they say cut, she had to kind of deal with this director being kind of a jerk to her. And I say kind of, I use that term, you know, lightly.
No. I didn't know that about Altman, actually. I don't know the stories
there. He admitted himself on, because they've made quite a few, Three Women, Brewster McCloud. On the DVD.
Popeye.
On the DVD commentary track for Three Women, Robert Altman just said flat out, he's just like, you know, for years, Shelley Duvall just kind of annoyed me because she's really like the character she plays. She's just a very super nice, sweet, somewhat naive person, and I always thought she was putting on an act, and it just kind of annoyed me, so I just wasn't very nice to her, and that's kind of like a jerk way to admit I know, it's just like it's tough, like in this world you can't just be a genuinely nice person with people without people thinking, you know, it's a front or something. So
and it, you know, it's even more to her credit because she was fucking fabulous in that movie. So the gold ball, the ballroom was actually not on that location, right? It was a different.
Yeah, the gold ballroom was built on stage 5, which was a horrendously bad stage, which was known for having pigeons nesting in the ceiling of it. And it wasn't really very soundproof at all. They used to shoot episodes of a TV series called The Avengers there in the 60s, which I think is very well known.
Yeah.
But they would do the stunt scenes in there because no dialogue was needed. So it didn't really matter that it wasn't very soundproof and the roof leaked and there were pigeons.
Right.
It was a pretty crummy kind of stage. And that's where the gold ballroom was, but originally before that they used it, the same stage for the apartment, the Boulder apartment that they live in at the start of the film.
Oh, wow. And that's so funny that it was such a crappy stage, because obviously it is, they transformed it into the most, one of the most beautiful sets, like literally in history. I mean, it's just couldn't be, that ballroom could not be more gorgeous.
That's it. Yeah. And there were thousands of formica tiles all spray painted gold.
Each one was painted by Mr. Ron Hunter. Pinter.
Yeah, that's him.
And it's so reflective. I was sort of marveling over how reflective that paint was, because you really don't see gold paint like that. I mean, it's just magnificent.
Ron wasn't famous. What they called it, gilding. And he was famous in the industry. His first job in the industry was painting C-3PO. For
really? Oh my gosh.
So he did the gold of C-3PO. He then did the gold of the Staff of Ra for Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant as well, later on after The Shining.
Oh my God, that's so funny. So that is C-3PO gold. Of course,
that makes perfect
sense. You know, you look at Star Wars and you just marvel at the robots, at how, you know, real they look. I mean, it's just...
It doesn't look like molded plastic. It feels like gleaming metal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're seeing a typewriter. Everyone has a sound they expect to hear when you're seeing a typewriter. And instead you hear, boom.
Yes, yes. Good point.
You don't know what it is until the scene progresses, and it's just very disconcerting, the same way that that tricycle sound is.
Yes, that's an excellent point. Yeah, suddenly you hear this violent, sharp boom, and it pulls out to like a messy couch with magazines all over it, and it pulls out further and further, and we see Jack throwing, not just tossing, not just, you know, lobbing, but really pitching hard a ball against specifically that painting of Indians. It's a sand painting above the fireplace of Indian iconography, Indian figures, Native American figures.
Or depending on which conspiracy theory you want, the white man against the Indian, or are those rockets heading to space?
I guess for me, the maze at the end of the movie is what haunted me the most, and the fear that I had the first times I saw the movie, and waiting for that final shot of Jack frozen in the maze.
Yeah,
the gradual realization on the great Jack Nicholson's face when he realizes that he has lost the fight, and that he is going to be trapped there.
Yeah,
he's not so mad that he doesn't realize what he has done, and it's very Oedipal.
Yeah. And again, the music is just insane. At the end of the movie,
it's
insane.
Just so you know, I think Kubrick uses two Penderecki, or maybe even three at once at the same time. He merges them.
Gordon Stainforth mentions that.
I mean, who made the decisions to make those merging of pieces? Was that Stainforth, or was it Kubrick, or was it both?
It was Stainforth. He really did have a lot of control. That was one place where Kubrick did feel confident enough in this guy that he really let him have a lot of control. And
that's really fascinating, because I was thinking to myself as I was watching Air Molecules dance in my apartment preparing for this interview that Kubrick was the ultimate control freak, and that he had to have his toe in everybody's water when making his movies. It's why it took so long to make his films. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, to have been there when he decided, put this in, put that in,
yeah,
with Penderecki. And now you tell me it was Stainforth.
It was absolutely Stainforth. And
that's great.
Because at one point Kubrick was like, this needs to be beefed up a little. And so he said, nobody notices, but I actually used two different pieces at the exact same time. And there's actually some points where there's like four layers of sound going on.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. And he ends it with saying, well, if you folks have any problems up there, just give us a call. And I think it might be a good idea if you leave your radio on all the time now. Over. Mm-hmm. And she says, okay, we'll do that. It was real nice talking to you. Bye. Over and out.
In her over place. And out. Yes.
Yeah. And out. In very out. Very out.
Very out.
And so, again, you know, it's a little hard to imagine anyway that, you know, it's in Ullman's office, so it's a little, you know, it's a little out of the way for them to really hear anything that's going on. I mean, if someone's attacking you with an axe in this hotel, I don't think the Rangers are going to hear it anyways.
Attacking me with an axe, over. Beating out profusely, over.
Yeah. The elevator scene, elevator of blood, that was a miniature. How big was that? Do you know?
No, it wasn't a miniature. This was filmed in the water tank. So the one which had the hedge exterior, just the exterior wall around it.
The Moby Dick Big Brother tank.
That's it, yeah. And that, because that was the place for them to unleash all these gallons of blood or whatever it really was. It's interesting. Doug Milsom filmed it. And yeah, he seemed to think it was either Kensington Gore, which is the name that they give. It's a brand of prop blood. And I've spoken to a man called George Gibbs, who is I don't know how many Oscars he's won. I think it was 4 Oscars and 5 BAFTAs or something. He's a multi-award winning visual effects and special effects man. And he said that he made up about 9 different barrels of different prop blood to different consistencies and colors. And Kubrick came along and went, that one. And then he said he made buckets full of stuff.
So it was fake.
But
sure.
Then a few other people seem to said, oh, no, I'm sure they got blood from a butcher and it was pig's blood. But I don't think that's true. I'm pretty sure George Gibbs.
Yeah, because the stench would have been pretty bad if it was real.
Oh, it would have been horrible. Yeah. But Doug himself had to stand with like a full on bodysuit and like a screen just in front of the camera and for them to unleash all this blood rushing out through these doors.
So how did they do it? So it was a recreation. Also, it was a life size. It was not a miniature. It was a life size.
It wasn't a miniature. It was full size. Yeah.
Of the elevator doors and these chairs. And then they just had giant tanks. And I just can't even imagine. I mean, are there photographs of that being done?
I have never seen any photos.
You know, the fear that she's feeling, the freezing, the feeling of freezing up and just being like this realization that comes over her of like, oh, I am in a dangerous situation. We all know. I mean, you know, women know that feeling.
And just psychologically how you can keep justifying it is such a perversion.
Right.
So, and yeah, like I feel total empathy for her. But what I'm creatively interested in or narratively is like, that split that she has to make, like I'm gonna walk away and just pretend to, because the next scene she's just playing.
Yeah,
like there should be serious alarm bells going off, like you would hope, but I know we aren't all, I mean, we all have done what she's done.
And and again, she's now trapped and there's not a whole lot of choices as far as, she could get confrontational with him, but we kind of get the feeling that would be a bad move. I get that feeling. Like that would escalate things more quickly. So, you know, I think it is a choice to either confront him or to say, I'm just going to make everything as smooth and comfortable as possible. So everybody's happy. I'm going to make sandwiches. I'm going to play with my child in the snow. And everything's going to, you know, just, we're going to coast this way until May.
And
know?
It just got really hard to pretend to do that.
Now, as far as the subliminal advertising, one of the conspiracy theorists, he was in Room 237, is Jay Wiedner. He did claim that Kubrick had, you know, was fascinated with the book
Subliminal Seduction.
Right, Subliminal Seduction.
I mean, if nothing, Stanley Kubrick was interested in screwing with our heads. I mean, he wanted to know how to do that in every way possible. He does all kinds of like strange continuity things in Clockwork Orange as well to mess with you and throw you off balance.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is really happening here and to a purpose.
And Jay Wiedner actually did say in Room 237 that he also met with advertising executives to ask them about their techniques. So again, I don't know if that's true. That's according to Jay Wiedner. Kubrick actually believed that it was possible that people at ESP, just as, you know, just to go on a tangent here with other new agey kind of thought in the 70s, he felt like his cat was evidence of, you know, that his cat could kind of predict what he wanted to do was evidence of this. You know, he spoke about this. And of course, again, the aliens thing. So he was interested in that kind of stuff. No question. It makes perfect sense that he would have found the subliminal advertising stuff, which is really, you know, pretty one foot in reality. I'm sure it's completely possible that some whiskey company put the word sex in an ice cube. Like, knowing what Madison Avenue is like, I am, you know, sure, that could very well, you know.
I always ask for those sex ice cubes in a bar, and they never give them to me.
I wonder about some of the implications of the owners of the hotel. I know you speculated that Ullman and Watson are ghosts, but it's interesting to me to think about them as humans who kind of facilitate this maybe recurring event, which Kind of one of the interesting parts of the movie to me. And then the Forest Rangers as well. I feel like, obviously, watching it multiple times, there's double meaning in a lot of what everyone says. So you can maybe read more into it than you should.
That's so cool, that idea that the Rangers are kind of going, yep, you'll be fine. You know, and they're being so kind of detached and smooth in the way Allman is and the way Watson is, because they understand what goes on at this hotel. That's like fascinating. I would never have thought of that. That's great.
Good call.
I love fan theories. I love it. So that's our new fan theory. The Rangers are in on it too. I love that. That's canon. It's canon now. So the dialogue here is, "Hello, Danny." And I can tell you the script I'm looking at, which I think is a somewhat official post-production script, actually says H-U-L-L-O. Hello, Danny. I thought
that was funny. Hello is so much friendlier than hello. Yeah.
Yes.
Hello with a British accent, but hello is more like sort of a goofy American hello, hello, hello.
It's more childlike.
Well, so perhaps I'll remake the scene and I'll dub in hello.
Hello.
Yeah, it's so much friendlier.
It is. So hello, Danny, come play with us. And then bong, come play with us, Danny, forever and ever. And Eva. And these girls are from Colorado, right? This is a Colorado hotel from the 1970s. I think that after you die, you end up, suggestion here is you become English after you die.
And once you become a ghost, you become English?
You get an accent, at least. You get an accent. I think the British accent is scarier. So if you're going to be a ghost, that could be part of your ghost training.
Are there any British people who are not ghosts, is my question, I guess, is where this is leading. I don't think so, because if you say to me, name some British people, I'm going to say, well, Winston Churchill, Shakespeare, like the whole list is dead people. It might be that all English, there's no English people alive, really. They're all ghosts, and the accent happens after.
That's why they're so much funnier than us, too, and they're so much cleverer than us, because they're dead, so they've been through it all. They know it all.
They have time to prepare material.
They have access to infinite knowledge, and that's why we're so dumb. So that explains a lot.
We're the kind of people who walk around going, hello!
So here we have, he puts him on his lap, gives him a kiss on the head, and starts playing with his hair, which is like almost painful to watch.
And they have a conversation, which I think you could replace all of Jack's dialogue with. Do you know the intro to the Butthole Surfers song, Sweet Loaf?
Yeah.
The daddy, yes, son, what does regret mean? Well, son, the funny thing about regret is that it's better to regret something you have done than to regret something you haven't done. And by the way, if you see your mom this weekend, be sure and tell her. And then the voice kicks in, and this probably wouldn't fit in the movie. Satan, 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 which I didn't realize is Jello Biafra actually apparently doing the intro on that record. But the whole time Jack was talking, I thought you could swap out his dialogue with the intro to that song, and it would have had exactly the same impact.
Daddy.
Yes, son.
What does regret mean?
Well, son, a funny thing about regret is that it's better to regret something you have done than to regret something you haven't done.
And then the final one that I can think of is the door key. And this, to me, is the flimsiest one of all, is the door to room 237. According to the lead conspiracy theorist in all this is Jay Wiedner. The distance to the moon is a mean of 237,000 miles, which isn't quite right. It's really 239,000 miles. So 237 was a number picked because of that number that was attached to the distance from Earth to Moon. And the door key says room no 237, which if you arrange the letters, you can make not very neatly.
You can make it say moron.
Moron or moon room, depending, depending on your take on all of this. But I do want to point out in the digital and Blu-ray editions of this movie, so if you buy the Blu-ray or if you see it digitally on the screen in a movie theater, this ball is now pink. And it's not supposed to be pink. In my edition, my DVD edition, the ball is yellow. So this is a strange color mistake.
Well, Warner Brothers has definitely gone on. I mean, it's been recorded that Warner Brothers has been pretty horrible to Leon Vitali since Kubrick's death, and that they basically have started, they treated him with great respect when Kubrick was around because they're worried about alienating Kubrick. But Leon Vitali's not been treated kindly. It makes me almost wonder, did they not solicit his input during this latest Blu-ray release?
Yeah, I would definitely like to know that. I had actually posted about this on my Twitter. Lee Unkrich, who's a real shining expert, didn't really know the answer. And Howie Berry from Elstree Studios didn't know the answer. So, yeah, I think we're going to have to see if we can find Leon and ask him about it. But clearly this is a mistake. And then if the little cars that are around him also in the original version were yellow, you would see wherever you see pink, you would see yellow. Yeah, I can't imagine how they made this mistake. This is such a huge mistake. And of course, Kubrick famously, you know, before Leon Vitali was dealing with the colorings, Kubrick was doing it himself. I mean, when they were putting out, you know, 2001 after the initial release in future releases, Kubrick was looking at that stuff himself and making sure. And he was,
I think, until his dying day, he still was. I mean, someone was talking about it while he was making Eyes Wide Shut, or maybe right beforehand, that he was still like watching hundreds of prints of Dr. Strangelove just to check and make sure they were precisely to his technical specifications and that sort of thing. It's one of the reasons that he died at 87. I mean, he was very prone to just chain smoke cigars and work himself into complete and total exhaustion.
Right. When they were filming 2001, they would have grayscales on every single shot. It's hard to explain, but I mean, this was just a time-consuming, insanely laborious process where they would be checking grayscales with the actual shooting and then with, you know, every single shot.
And I love the letters he would send to theaters about how to properly project his movies. I mean, some of these letters are the stuff of legend.
He would check with theaters to see what kind of projectors they had. It's crazy. He was really, really into making sure. But, you know,
he's getting it right.
He wanted his audience to have the best possible experience.
Well, here's my question is, I would assume, so it's really since 2001 was released in 1968, which is quite a lot of, it was 10 years before they started filming The Shining, people had been batting around the idea of Kubrick faking the moon landing. So Kubrick obviously knew about this. So I think, I don't know why nobody brings this up. I think he's playing with the audience, having that sweater on Danny. He's like totally winking at us. He's elbowing us in the ribs with that sweater. And I think that's really actually charming. You know, nobody looks at it that way. It's either there or it's not there. I think it is there. I think he is sort of saying, hey, moon landing here, you know, but I think he's totally busting our balls. And beautiful crossfade again into this very like technical looking, we're in the boiler room. So we have two boilers.
Yeah, we see Wendy is in the boiler room and she's got like a clipboard and she's checking these two enormous, almost anthropomorphic, what look like locomotive boilers.
Some people point out that in the background, if you do some super close-ups here, you'll see pornographic images.
There's some girly pictures on the wall.
Girly pics.
Yeah, this is the realm of the caretaker. Right. So
the guys who normally would be working in the basement of the hotel, these are the maintenance guys, you know, during the year, it would be a bunch of maintenance guys.
So it's hard to imagine elegant Mr. Grady dwelling in this area. This is the bowels of the hotel.
Oh, I guarantee Mrs. Grady was down there with her clipboard.
You're right. Yes. So right.
I can hear Stephen King, like somewhere in Maine, Stephen King just sat up and made grouchy faces. somewhere somebody is misinterpreting The Shining.
And all right, so she says, oh my God, Danny, what happened to your neck? Danny, what happened to your neck? And she picks him up. And here we have.
And he changes.
We have the debut when she's standing of dummy Danny. That is not a real, that is not a real child right there. That is a prop made to look like
That's
Danny.
That's a good prop.
It's a very good prop.
Yeah, in the book, this is all manifestly a hallucination.
Yes.
He sits down at the bar, he starts talking to Lloyd, and Lloyd's dialogue is, it's not in quotes, it's just presented as part of the paragraphs. It's so clear that he's not talking to somebody who's there, and he has Lloyd line up 20 martinis on the bar that he's going to drink, and starts drinking them, but he's not getting drunk, because he's not drinking, and Wendy comes in and interrupts his hallucination because none of this is actually happening. It's clearly in his head. Making it physical and real, making it something that we can see, making it something that he's like reacting to in the moment, I think is such a more interesting choice for a movie.
Yeah.
Because there's so much unsettling going on in this sequence, and the music at all times is telling us to be unsettled. But there's nothing here more unsettling than his lack of shock at what's just happened. Mm-hmm. He's referring to Lloyd by name like they're old friends, yeah. And that cut to, oh, everything's changed.
But I just wanted to know, like, how big of a compliment is he giving Lloyd? So I looked it up. From Timbuktu to Portland, Maine, it's approximately 4,292 miles.
Nice.
That's pretty impressive. Wow. And I looked up, I went on Google Maps to see, like, the way to get there. And it literally says you can't. I looked for transit directions, and it said there are none. Driving directions said, sorry, we could not calculate driving directions from Timbuktu, Mali to Portland, Maine. Walking directions, no dice. Absolutely
of
not.
Of course.
No, yeah. No way. Anyway, then I put in Portland, Oregon, which is from Timbuktu to Portland, Oregon is 6,715 miles.
Jeez.
So that's a pretty good upgrade he gives him there when he adds Portland, yeah. Oregon. That's a 2,500 mile extra compliment he's giving him.
So when Kubrick was putting this movie together, he immediately thought of Joe Turkel for this role, first choice. He said, Joe, I don't want a ghostly ghoul or something like that. I want a nice smiling fella, pleasant.
He seems to have kind of compromised those two.
He does look a little ghoulish.
And I'll read you a little bit of what Joe said about playing this role. He says, I wanted to be pleasantly sarcastic. That was in my mind. I was also thinking that this Jack guy is a prick and he's out of his fucking mind. But he's but he's a patron and I have to humor him. We're in Florida and we are in Mr. Holleran's summer hideaway. On the sides of his bureau are two stacks of albums. You can see one of the albums very clearly. And I posted on Twitter and Facebook, said, what is this album cover? And somebody actually figured it out. The album cover we figured out is Steel Eye Span, Commoner's Crown, an album from 1975. And what's interesting about that is the last track on that album has Peter Sellers on it. So, and I didn't find it anywhere on the internet.
But no, yeah. I've never heard that. That's not, I think you just made history.
Cracked a case.
Come on, Min. Play that modern banjo, Min.
Huge thanks to everyone who has guested on the show so far, especially New Yorker cartoonist Joe Dader and cinephile Megan Dooley, who have been my most frequent guests and wonderful collaborators, and I can't thank them enough. Also, I would like to thank Pete the Retailer from Star Wars Minute, Tasha Robinson from The Verge and the Next Picture Show podcast, Bob Kester from the Immunities podcast, Elizabeth Yaffe, producer for the wonderful documentary on Lan Vitale, film worker, actress Zandi Hartig, from such shows as Children's Hospital and the wonderful Soderbergh HBO show Mosaic, Kevin Marr from Kevin Geeks Out, John Solomon from WPRB, John Cribbs from The Pink Smoke, Marcus Pinn from Pinland Empire, Howie Berry from Elstree Studios, John Schnall from WFMU, musicologist Jonathan Stern, John Engel from Off Kilter Compositions and the Alien Minute podcast. Stuart Thorndike, who was in Eyes Wide Shut and who is a horror writer and director of the film Lyle. Patreon, Brian Dupree. James Hancock, host of Wrong Real podcast. Heidi Bennett, host of A Cabin Minute cast. And writer and activist Johnny Coleman. And I have so many fantastic people lined up for the second half of this podcast for the rest of the movie, including Mike White from the Projection Booth podcast, Dan McCoy from the Flophouse, Gina Radcliffe from the Kill by Kill podcast, Vanity Fair film writer Bruce Handy. And if you are a person who's been involved with The Shining in any way, and you're listening to this podcast and you're interested in coming on, of course I'd love to have you on. I can be reached through either Twitter or Facebook, or email is sakrug@aol.com. I'm very proud of my very nerdy email address. Thank you to the audience so much for listening, and especially for Patreons for helping to support the show. Please do also check out my Patreon page, where you can support the show with a very small $3.50 monthly subscription. You'll get lots and lots of bonus content, including looks at his other movies. Some really fantastic roundtables are up there, and I'm working next week. I'll be doing one on The Killing. Also, I have stickers for Patreons. Do check that out at patreon.com/theshining237. And next week, we will be back with a regular episode of The Shining 237. We will be hitting the halfway point of the movie. And again, thank you so much for listening.